from I Didn't Come Up Anything Clever this week. This is the People's Square. I'm your host, Borozoi. With me, as always, is Eric Stryker.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of the People's Square. I'm getting a little bit of an echo.
Let me turn my volume might be up. See if that works for you right there.
Okay. It's getting better. All right. So today I am happy to present a friend of mine, Josh Neal. He has a brand new book out called American Extremist, which I got a review copy of it. I've read about halfway. It's one of the best books criticizing liberalism from a scholarly perspective that I've read in recent years. It's definitely up there with Caldwell's Age of Entitlement. It's up there with Christopher Lash's Revolt of the Elites. But what's so interesting about it is that Neil has, or I'll just call him Josh, has a background in psychology. So he attacks liberalism from that perspective, which is so important because a lot of the liberal underpinnings come from psychology and psychiatry and so on. So welcome, Josh.
Dude. Yeah, thanks for having me on, guys. It's a pleasure to be on here.
Yes. So, anyway, again, I'm getting an echo. Is that you, Borzoi, or is it Josh?
Let me switch off. Maybe if it's something going on with my voice meter. Let me just switch off for you. That should help you out.
All righty. Test.
Wait, just a second. I gotta switch it over.
Testicle.
All right. See if that works better for you. See if that works better for you, Stryker.
Yeah. Hello. Yes. So one thing I'm going to say right now is in recent months, there have been a ton of high quality dissident books coming out. And I have to emphasize on high quality. It's not just another novel about shooting blacks from outer space or something. It's like these are like actual scholarly critiques of the paradigm we're living in and the various different factors that led to this moment. So Josh, let me ask you something here. So the book starts off with kind of like a bunch of anecdotes about your own life and your experience in academia. Why don't you go and go ahead and talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I did, obviously everyone knows, I guess the cat's out of the bag, right? I was a teacher in New York City, and, you know, I hesitate to use the word that I was in academia or anything like that because I never had ambitions for that kind of thing. And I never taught at any prestigious universities. So I can't give you the inside dirt on, like, you know, Columbia University or whatever. But I taught at a lot of different schools, a lot of different environments, a lot of different types of people, working class in trade schools, upper middle class white kids in Catholic schools, and then, you know, city college, or, you know, the CUNY system. So every kind of person you're going to meet in New York, I had in my classroom. And I had a few very eye-opening experiences talking to faculty, people who are running the departments, people who are running the schools. None of these anecdotes are in the book, so I guess this is primo content for your audience. Ooh. But I remember the very first teaching job I had, the guy who's, you know, walking me through the faculty office and the different departments and how to get from one place to the other. It's basically, I mean, in only so many words, I don't want to put words in the guy's mouth. He was a total dick. So, I mean, I'm not trying to be polite to the guy. Total son of a bitch. But he's like, yeah, basically the kids here are idiots. And it's beneath you to be teaching them. But all the same, we're here. And that was my first day, you know, as an instructor. And I was only like, 7 months out of grad school. And so I was like, good Lord, man. Like, why do you have this attitude? Well, I mean, I know why. Because,
yeah.
The fact that I even got hired to teach is an indictment of the education system.
You know, when I was younger, I actually went to college, and I briefly considered becoming a lecturer or a professor, because it seems that on paper it would be highly stimulating and satisfying to be teaching adults, you know, to be sharing ideas with adults, sharing knowledge and wisdom with them and so on. But yeah, by the time I graduated college, I was very, let's just say, pessimistic about those prospects and the very system of education in America, which is just the 11th grade, isn't it? I mean, not the 11th grade, I'm sorry, the 13th grade.
Well, that was certainly my experience. And you have a lot of people who basically really should have been in just like every discipline in a remedial class. It's shameful. It's a disgust. I mean, we could go on and on about it, but the education system was
not to cut you off, but just a funny anecdote. I had a professor in college who was she was doing a PhD in history, and her PhD, she was like in her late 20s, kind of like a cute girl type of thing with the big glasses and so on. And her PhD thesis was on anal sex in 16th century Holland. So that this is her PhD thesis. Oh, Josh, just did he come back?
I'm still here.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, that just shows you the level that American academia is on right now. It's just a money grab. It's corrupted by the grant system. Public grants, like we saw this the other day with NYU with that ridiculous study that says that censorship is a figment of your imagination, funded by Craig Newmark, a billionaire and ADL member who is literally lobbying Silicon Valley to censor people as he funds studies saying there's no censorship. So that alone, that gives you a glimpse into this corrupt system, doesn't it?
Yeah, I knew a woman who was going for her PhD in a like one of these health science programs, and the guy who ran the department was being investigated for basically doing all these fraudulent kinds of grant claims, and he was sexually harassing the faculty, sexually harassing the female students, but he generated all this income for the school by doing these bogus grants and studies, and that's, you know, that's not just something that's like in these, you know, maybe disciplines that people would knee-jerk poo-poo, like health science or sociology or psychology, or whatever. It's become endemic to the whole university system.
Yeah.
I mean, think about who's that guy, Lawrence Krauss, right? Another one of these guys. I don't think he was doing anything necessarily financially fraudulent, but he was dealing with like sexual harassment claim after sexual harassment claim. So it's just, it really is a environment for people with not a lot to offer, but a lot, but who want to take advantage, exploit, basically naive people. And mm-hmm. that's where it is.
Yeah.
To the point you mentioned about the woman with the anal sex, doctoral or thesis or whatever. I had a conversation with the woman who was the head of the sociology department. And, I remember this was like just as the Trump campaign was kicking off. And I just kind of mentioned offhand Scott Adams. Yeah. For a while, I remember what the context was, and she like immediately recoiled, jumped back in her seat. She's like, "Oh my god!" And it's like, Scott Adams is like the most milquetoast person you could possibly think of, and you have this like well-to-do bourgeois liberal woman biting her fingernails and freaking out. And her area of study as a sociologist was sex shops.
Like, oh, typical.
What kinds of things people purchase and what they use them for. So it's just like, you're such an unserious person. Give me a break.
Yeah, I mean, talk about the lowest common denominator. Someone actually made a joke that that's why they call Holland the Netherlands. Ha! So anyway, let's get right into the book. So I found a lot to talk about, but I'm just going to – we only have about an hour and a half here, 2 hours. So we just get right to the basics. So the theme of the book is actually kind of a radical attack on liberalism. Basically, your theory, and correct me if I'm wrong, your theory or hypothesis is if liberal elites, liberal myth makers, begin to distort reality, then expect the population to start losing track of reality, thus mental illness. And the best part is that again, your theory is that psychology and psychiatry in post-war America isn't intended to cure mental illness. It's actually used to break your will and deliberately inflict mental illness. Am I miscategorizing you in any way?
In only so many words, I mean, that's more or less the argument I make, especially the first part of that. Yeah, and I'm sure you know a lot about this, Stryker. You think of all of these OSS-connected psychiatrists from Canada and the United States, like Ewan Cameron and Henry Murray, who are basically had their fingers in the pots of every evil, twisted thing that the North American continent has been involved in over the last 60, 70 years. Ewan Cameron and Henry Murray both famously were basically employed to do a psychological profile of, you know, these illiberal 20th century dictators, quote unquote. And yeah. It's all this really juvenile pee pee poo poo caca. Hitler is a secret homosexual Jewish African. You know, he smears his own feces on his face and he loves it. And it's just, you know, it presages the modern kind of psyop of humiliation. Like, whereas 60, 70 years ago, they did these kinds of psychological profiles to humiliate the leadership of their opposition and to demoralize their people. They've so successfully done that they've turned all of those techniques on just average people. And Ewan Cameron, of course, connected to a lot of these, I guess what people would call MK Ultra studies, which started very early on with the exploration of various psychedelics and inebriative substances as truth serum type of treatments and other, you know, basically breaking people down psychologically. So like a Sirhan situation. So you can implant a new consciousness in this person and then have them do whatever it is that you want them to do. That was allegedly shut down, but it continued for several decades. And Henry Murray, I think, ran the study that basically turned Ted Kaczynski into a human vegetable. Like, these people are they're cruel. You know, you think about Jay Dyer's a guy who talks a lot about all these mind control government psyop programs, and they're fundamentally just devising the whole. Western approach to social science since, you know, over the last 100-150 years is just about how do you create the kind of person who will conform to a extreme liberal society, or actually the phrase I use in the book is an anti-society, because it doesn't really have any of the hallmarks of what would be, you know, a healthy eusocial environment where people can prosper and participate in the good and retains a sense of dignity and feel gratitude about life. So, yeah, there was a second part to what you said, but I kind of lost track, so I'll just kick it back over.
Yeah. So a couple of things about that. You know, one thing, and this is, again, let me just preface this by saying it's baseless speculation, but I think it's kind of interesting that there hasn't really been a high-profile serial killer in a long time. It seems like the serial killer epidemic was big in the 70s and 80s into the 90s, but it seems to have kind of dropped off into a different form of kind of nihilistic violence, which is the school shooting and so on. So, if I were to baselessly speculate, you know, what if some of those serial killers were part of some kind of program like Whitey Bulger was? Whitey Bulger had never killed anyone until Gottlieb. The Jew Gottlieb from MK Ultra started feeding him LSD for sometimes months every single day. And then he became this notorious killer who was being handled by the FBI the entire time.
Stryker, you're talking about one of my favorite conspiracy theories, my favorite one of all. I often call serial killers a social construct because they're a very media generated phenomenon. There's a lot of spooky shit. A lot of serial killers had military backgrounds. I'll let you guys talk for a second. That's my favorite conspiracy theory.
Yeah, there's a book. There's actually a book about MK Ultra about who's the guy Gottlieb, was it, or Gott?
Oh yeah, for the MK Ultra guy was Gottlieb. Sidney Gottlieb.
Yeah.
Sidney Gottlieb.
And there's a book all about him. How, and the author, it's so funny because the author was saying, you know, we've talked about MK Ultra. There's tons of books about it, but no one ever talks about Sidney Gottlieb, who was the literal mastermind of it. And he was the first to really write a book about it. And of course, the reason for that is we know why. He was the first to write a book about it, and it details all this stuff, all these like experiments on military bases where they were getting people and drugging them and doing all kinds of, you know, psychological manipulations of them, you know, things that I don't personally believe in 100%. But there were some cases where I think I've spoken about this before, where a man on one of these military bases subjected to these experiments got off the military base, murdered murdered and raped a 2-year-old girl, and didn't even know he did it, you know. And then we see the same thing with, as you said, Sirhan, and various others. And someone was telling me that what it probably was is that they canceled the experiments because they found that just paying someone to do an assassination was actually a better deal and more reliable than trying to use mind control tactics and so on. But another thing I'll say about the CIA and so on, there's a book that I don't know if you've ever read it. It's about how the U.S. government during the Cold War hired a group of Marxists, anti-Soviet Marxists. It's called Imaginary Futures. Have you ever heard of it, Josh?
No, Richard, I'm not familiar.
So during the Cold War, the U.S. government hired some like Trotskyists or something to create a theory of history that would use Marxist materialistic theory, the dialectical history of Marxism, but instead of having communism as the end goal, it would be neoliberalism. And that this whole book details that. It's absolutely fascinating. But would you agree that the post-war American project and the Soviet Bolshevik one have very similar psychological and socio-ethical profiles and foundations? Would you agree with that?
Yeah. I mean, you go back to Marx, everyone knows. I mean, the guy's basically building on the English and Scottish Enlightenment principles. So I think of it at this point as just a continuation of the same logic of the British Empire. Ricardo Smith is feeding into Marx, and then the people who move forward from Marx, you get all of these, what would be, I guess, from a non-specialist point of view, what would be contradicting worldviews like libertarianism and communism, or conservatism and communism. And it seems that if you just push these kind of dialectics far enough, they always go in the same place. And at the bottom of these things, I hate to bring the guy's name up because I actually do kind of like the work that he does. Caleb Maupin.
Yeah.
Caleb did a series of tweets not too long ago talking about how his communist utopia is that you just have more billionaires. Everyone will be a billionaire. Everyone will be wealthy. And you know, the idea that you create some utopic state where everyone just has this surplus reserve of money or this surplus reserve of time to be a bohemian, just kind of fails for all the reasons I think we've seen historically. And if you have a sense of what people are really like, even the average person, that's not what people generally speaking want. But without getting off track here. Yeah, I mean, I don't really see these things as any different. And it's funny when you get like supposed free market people debating communists, they accept all of the same. I'm thinking again of Stefan Molyneux. There's a period where Molyneux was debating all of these guys from Zero Books, Ben Burgess, their editor, whose name escapes me at the moment.
Yeah.
And they're just arguing over the how of getting to the exact same point that they both really want to get to.
Yeah.
And
Ben Burgess in particular is his argument with libertarians is that I have a different math equation towards the same goal. That's really what it is. They really are kind of obsessed with analytical philosophy at zero books, just like libertarians are. So the actual way of explaining the world is not that different. And the first principles are identical. Another thing too, and this is more of a layman's point, the manifestations of social degradation of the latter year Soviet Union, latter years in the USSR, like economic decline, social nihilism, high suicide rates, deaths of despair, we're starting to see this breakdown happening in the United States now. And would you say that they're caused by the same fundamental issues with these two materialistic philosophies?
Yeah, I'll have to cuck out a little bit on this one because I'm not a historian and I don't actually know a whole lot about Soviet Russia, say, towards the end of its lifespan. I've known a lot of people, again, teaching, I knew a lot of people who came over from former Soviet states. And a lot of them would tell me they had it pretty good. So, I mean, I know it's, you know, the Soviet Empire covered a large landmass. There's a lot of different peoples. They all had differing levels of success and failure. And so I don't know if getting this, I'm not the person to comment one way or the other, but I think if you're this is what distinguished, say, Stalinist Marxism from Leninist Marxism, for example, was Stalin basically reintroduced the Volk, reintroduced the heroism of the Russian people back into their culture so that they could win military campaigns.
Yeah.
And that was a stark, maybe you can correct me on this, Stryker. My understanding of the Leninist Marxist period is very liberal in terms of loosening, making abortion available, loosening the standards for divorce, sexual liberation, all these kinds of things.
Capitalism.
Yeah, right. What's the difference, really?
Trotsky and Lenin privatized the czarist state enterprises in oil and so on. They were working with Wall Street, getting in mass investments, liberalizing the economy. Libertarians eat your heart out. They even had competing currencies in the early years of the USSR. It wasn't until Stalin that they actually came up with implementing the planned economy. The NEP was a national economic policy or program, and it kind of dovetailed with the social liberalism. So there's more social liberalism and there's more capitalism and then economic liberalism. And then with Stalin later on, there was less capitalism and less social liberalism. So clearly the two are connected. And I think the distinction between late Soviet period and America is that ironically, the booted commissars actually kind of let up a little bit towards the end. We saw this with Gorbachev. He had glasnost, perestroika opened up and let up a little bit in hopes of probably preventing a civil war or an uprising. And the difference between that and the American oligarchy is that while the Soviets loosened things up a little bit and try to meet the people halfway, to their detriment in retrospect, the American oligarchy is just pressing the pedal to the metal. They're like, oh, you guys are mad? Fine. We're just going to escalate this. Isn't that interesting? And it goes with your book because you say that our elites are psychotic. So anyway, could you go into that a little bit? The pathocrats?
I get that phrase from Andrew Lobachevsky, who – there's a little bit of a conspiracy theory that he was not a real person. And if you look into his history online, it's hard for me to judge anything I see in some of these forums. But he was a Polish psychiatrist. He was one of the last generation of psychiatrists to be trained in Poland before the basic Marxist overthrowing of Poland or the Soviets coming in. And so he gets this more genetic, biological education, a fuller psychological training. And then once Poland is taken over, that you get in this behaviorist attitude towards psychology, kind of this Marxist science that was coming from what's the guy's name? Alexandria Luria, I think, is one of the names. Lev Vygotsky. They were trying to create this. Basically, you had these social science guys, Lysenko being another one of these people in Russia, who were trying to create this idea of the new Marxist man through these revolutionary social sciences. Anyway, they come in. Lobachevsky lives through this whole experience and documents as part of a team of Polish psychiatrists studying these different people and kind of trying to figure out almost like a pseudo phrenology, skull shape, brain areas that may be contributing to their psychopathic conduct, and doing all these tests. Anyway, he tries to publish the book 3 or 4 times. And at one point, so the story goes, I can never pronounce this guy's name, Brzezinski. Zbigniew Brzezinski blocks the publishing of this book. Again, I don't know if that's true or not, but that's the myth of the story. And so the book finally gets released like 15, 16 years ago. And he makes this argument that you have basically a healthy society, noblesse oblige, a respect for the dignity of the common people. And then to use kind of like a Tolkien reference, you get this worm tongue character who insinuates himself into the power structure and then starts purging the sane, healthy, benevolent leaders, and then recruiting minions effectively to fill up the ranks. Basically, bio-Leninism is a very similar hypothesis. You get rid of the old leadership, you install a new leadership who are subservient to you, and the kinds of people who could never succeed or climb up the social ladder of their own validity, of their own merits.
Yeah.
He terms this the pathocracy because these are psychopaths. And there's one study I cite, which is a very famous study in the book by a team of researchers, I think in Australia and New Zealand. And they argue that something like 1 out of 10 CEOs are clinical psychopaths. And so some further research has extended that finding to politicians, to really any person in a liberal capitalist society who is at the top of the food chain. Because you think about what kind of person is going to excel in these environments. They're going to be exploitative. They're going to be manipulative. They're going to be two-faced. They're going to be brown nosers. And they're going to be fundamentally people who can't actually do the job, but they can do the job of screwing everyone that's talented and capable in front of them and getting power over whatever environment that they're in. So the pathocracy, which I think explains the situation that we're dealing with, literally. I don't know if you remember that study showing how many of the American politicians were on basically anti-Alzheimer's medication.
Wow.
So whether they're like defective in terms of their personality, or they just have nervous systems that don't work anymore, these are defective people, and they're in charge of everything.
Joe Biden, John McCain, you know, we could go on and on. I mean, I think that 1 in 10 figure is probably an undercount, frankly. But this does go into the chapter in your book on authoritarians versus anti-authoritarians, in the sense that the average right winger, because of these corrupted first principles, the corrupted myth, as you say, we'll see that they're ruled by psychopaths and assume a correlation that is not causation, which is that absolute power makes you crazy. And that, again, dovetails with the behavioralist style of psychology rather than the biological one. I mean, the absolute Occam's razor explanation for why we're ruled by psychopaths is that the actual sovereign that is invisible is psychotic or ill-wishing, and they actively select for psychopaths. For example, if you go out there and say with a straight face that a woman can have a dick, that is a sign that you're willing to say anything to advance. You have no respect for the truth or ethics or integrity. You are simply willing to say whatever you need to say to climb up the ladder. And I think the way liberal plutocracies are structured, particularly by the Jewish sovereign, they structure the carrots and sticks on purpose to select for criminals, for, like you said, psychopaths, sociopaths, and just outright evil, defected people, don't they?
Yeah, and to your point, the more bald-faced the lie that these people have to espouse, you're further, it has a twofold function. Not only are you selecting for these really malfeasant characters, but you're just forcing anybody who would be useful or have a good moral character out of the culture entirely. I mean, there just becomes a point, although I don't know if I really believe this, to be perfectly honest with you. Every day I wake up and I think, well, surely this is the news story that will make everybody quit their corporate job and you know, become a radical revolutionary, and it keeps not happening. So I don't really know. But the more bald-faced the lie, you're selecting for increasingly crazier, despotic people. And so the point about the authoritarian, anti-authoritarian thing, the whole dichotomy to me is a falsehood, because here's my hot take on the anarchist. Anarchism is just patricide. It's just deicide with the aim of installing these really malfeasant people as the new authoritarian, right? Mm-hmm. And you see, like, with these, you get the cucky soy boy, I guess, bugman types who may really believe all of the woke progressive stuff. And then you get the ones that will claim that they believe it, but are really just like aggressive, high testosterone men that are like, well, this is the path of least resistance. I can shoot right to the top. I can have access to all of the women, or let's be honest, children and men, and all money and influence. And they wear the mask of anarchism as a expedient route to get to the top. So this idea, and you get people like Noam Chomsky, Bruce Levin, who are these prominent theorists behind anti-authoritarianism, and they make it sound principled. And it's basically an appeal to a kind of enlightened individual who has, as you're saying, they have these certain moral principles. They're evaluating authority or would-be authority figures based on the quality of their character, and their vision, and all of what we would consider to be noble things. But really, they're just, you know, effectively opposed to the heritage American authoritarian. And they're opposed to the classically, somebody, I think Morgoth did a video about this book earlier, and someone in the comments section said something to the effect of, America has always been a fascist nation. Or maybe Mike from Imperious Press, Imperium Precedence. I heard it earlier today. And it's fundamentally, there's a certain truth to that in some sense. We pioneered economic protectionism. Mm-hmm. We had all these, you know, kind of like proto-fascist, you could say, policies and approaches. But they're just, they're dressing up their anti-American, anti-European fetish as a kind of principled, enlightened, individual pursuit of truth and nobility. And you mentioned Chris Lash and Chris Dexionism at the start of the broadcast. Mm-hmm. We had all these guys that drew a tremendous amount of influence from in writing this book. And it's kind of a very similar thesis that you have this schism at these particular points in American history where things go dramatically in the direction that we're at now.
Yes. That's what Lash's book Revolt of the Elites is about. I think that Revolt of the Elites is kind of underrated. I think his book The Culture of Narcissism is a bit overrated, but Revolt of the Elites, the main theory of it is that elites are radically changing society in a negative way to disempower the majority. But more so, what really stuck with me was the part where he talks about the university system. And I believe he was writing this in many, many years ago, decades ago. This is already happening, where he was talking about how anti-colonialist ideology or anti-white ideology was dominant in the university system. And that when this happens, when the gatekeepers of reason and wisdom are enthralled by this ideology or have this ideology imposed on them, it makes reason and truth in a world where Plato is dismissed as an old white man that should be ignored, suddenly the very concept of truth becomes white supremacy. And if white supremacy is the ultimate evil, then truth is the ultimate evil. And that's why we live in a society where truth is no defense anymore. It was totally building up to this moment. Now, one of the chapters I found interesting as well was your kind of study and commentary on studies on journalists as the ultimate keepers of the myth. Now, I've actually noticed something interesting about these kind of liberal or even Antifa journalists, in that they're very much obsessed with what you call the Menachian or kind of like a comic book understanding of right and wrong. And in some cases, literally, like you see references to comic books on their profiles and shit. Like they see themselves as Spider-Man.
Captain America.
Yeah. I wish I was exaggerating, but there's men in their 40s that are journalists, Antifa journalists, that have Spider-Man all over their, they have a picture of Spider-Man on their wall. I remember years ago I saw an interview with Michael Edison Hayden. He had a fucking picture of Spider-Man on his wall. So go into detail about the people attracted to institutional journalism, their role as myth makers in this psychotic society, and the research that's been done showing their enormous levels of mental illness and dysfunction.
Yeah, you know, there's a really great study that a Canadian academic, T.A. Jackson, shared that I wish I was able to put in this book. I couldn't find it. You might not be surprised to hear this. It's very difficult to find this information. Like, very difficult to find anything.
Who's going to report to our offices?
Right. Maybe it's because I was using Google. I don't know. Maybe shame on me. Maybe I should have been using DuckDuckGo or something. But yeah. It's very difficult to find this kind of information. But the research I found was more global. So you have high incidences of alcohol abuse. You have high instances of post-traumatic stress disorder, and some of it doesn't neatly fit in to support the hypothesis. I want to be, you know, the one of the driving impetuses behind the book is that I'm trying to be transparent about what I'm presenting. I don't want to be, there's no way to be a nonpartisan, but I wanted to, you know, put that forward as much as possible. So, like, you would expect that, say, the reporter who's whatever, they're in Burma, or maybe they were in Iraq in 2002 or three, might have something like post-traumatic stress disorder because they are in these war-torn regions. They're more or less in these very violent, dangerous environments, and it's damaging their nervous system. Their, you know, IEDs are going off, whatever the case might be. But yeah, you have high instances of PTSD, high instances of substance abuse and alcohol abuse, high rates of depression. So these are very unwell people generally, whether they are like beat reporters or whatever the case might be. And if I recall the study that T.A. Jackson shared, you know, they are very highly anxious, very depressed, very narcissistic. And I think that the changing media landscape, lowering, T.A. Jackson again would say journalists are always terrible and they were always low class. G.K. Chesterton wrote about that as well. They're always this rat class of people. So I don't want to get too heavy on this point that it's really bad now, but with the kind of internet journalism and clickbait journalism, it really does select for very stupid, unimaginative, manipulative people who, because of their stupidity and their lack of creativity, and they are always hired. I mean, think about like the people who got hired by BuzzFeed or Vice to a great degree. Are who's that one woman, Ellie Reeve?
Yeah,
the blonde with the glasses. Like exceptionally stupid people. Like,
yeah,
it's hard. It's difficult to find people this uninteresting, uncharismatic. And
that's why they write about other people for a living.
Yeah, they latch on to somebody out of, I don't know, probably latent sexual attraction, to be frank, or they want to be in the shine of actually talented, capable people, the kinds of people who go after you or say Richard or whoever else are really these kinds of people that just want to, on some level, bask in the afterglow of people who are really dangerous. You know, if you're writing a hit piece on whatever, some guy who got expelled from the military because he was shitposting on Telegram, like you're not actually dangerous. You're not actually doing anything that's resisting, trying to push back against the tide of evil. You are the tide of evil. You are the shock troopers. You're the first wave of stormtroopers who are enforcing the neoliberal moral ethic everywhere you go. And so, you know, one of the things I point out is that with these like digital journalists, it's not a profession where you generate a lot of money. It's not a profession where you're ever going to be financially stable. You get all of these like supposedly high status living in Brooklyn journalist types working for BuzzFeed, Vice, whatever, broadly, pick whatever bourgeois, like neoliberal outfit that you want, and they're destitute. Who's that, who's that guy that Sam Hyde mocked in an interview?
Joe
Bernstein.
Bernstein, yeah.
Yeah, Blockhead Joe. Like, you have these people, they're living in closets, they have Rick and Morty t-shirts on, they are smoking pot all day, they're obese, they're disgusting to look at, and they are competing in a wide market where you have to escalate the kind of craziness of your own headlines or the stories that you're pursuing just to be able to stay above water. And most of these outfits fail. Even the ones that are subsidized still fail because people, you know, the heyday of Vice was like 10 years ago or longer, right? And they've been living off the fumes of that for 6, 7, 8 years. You know, they never really had, they were never really hegemonic. They were just kind of flash in the pan places. And then HBO picks up Vice and nobody really watches it because the moment was over. They never really had anything in the first place. I mean, the General Buck Naked documentary was interesting, but that was about it. So it's selecting for people who are very cutthroat, very stupid, very narcissistic. And in particular, because the culture, the neoliberal culture places such a heavy emphasis on victimization as a journalistic narrative. I hesitate to use Ocasio-Cortez as an example because I feel a slight bit of sympathy for her.
Her fault she's dumb.
Huh?
It's not her fault that she's really dumb.
I mean, I don't want to get off on a tangent.
Well, one thing I'll say is that there is something intuitive, not like it's what you're saying is intuitively true, but there's also something about the journalistic profession, like you were saying. Like, I'll tell you in my case, for example, some of those things like that you were describing, journalists, like some of the problems they're having and so on, like drinking a little too much and so on. Ever since I started doing journalism myself, I've had to kind of clip some of those things because they were inching into my life, like really bad habits. And I had to kind of like pull myself back and be like, okay, I need to take a little break from doing journalism, which I did over the summer, before the summer actually, and be like, and I got to get myself together here so I can focus. There's something about that line of work that does take a toll on you after a bit.
Well, it's the ultimate Nietzschean, like staring into the void. If you really are someone that is determined to speak truth to power, uncover conspiracies, out really bad people, you're putting yourself in danger. You're living this very risky lifestyle, and that comes with certain stresses. And that's a little bit different than the kind of person I'm describing, where they are dysfunctional from the jump. And they're engaging in dysfunctional conduct, as opposed to someone who is really kind of heroic, like yourself, and you're doing this real. I'm not saying that's to gust you up, but I mean, really, I mean, I cite some of your articles on national justice for this book because I literally couldn't find anything else. Like, nobody else reporting. Well, your article has a face. Basically, nobody else is reporting on that.
I think the distinction is that, you know, what I try to do with my stuff is I try to attack people in my weight class or higher. What I noticed about Antifa journalists, the people at Vice, the people at Huffington Post, and all these kind of lowlives, is that they have this weird elitist. A lot of them come, even though they're downwardly mobile, they come from elite backgrounds. You know, for example, who would ever think that someone like a Luke O'Brien is a Harvard graduate? Okay, with that, that's like a trust fund guy and shit, you know. And I think that what goes into your mental illness hypothesis about journalists is this, and I don't know if you've noticed this too, but this kind of this urge to hurt people of lower status or hurt people who are weaker than you. Where the hell does that come from?
Well, these are the same people who've been telling us forever, you have to punch up, not punch down. So now that the heritage Americans, white people have precipitously declined, suddenly that changes. Wow. You know, imagine my shock. I'm totally surprised that they would do that. But yeah, these are vindictive people. And neoliberalism selects for vindictive, petty people. They're not just satisfied. You ever see that movie? Good Lord, There Will Be Blood.
Yes.
There's that famous scene where Plainview is talking. He's sitting around the campfire with this guy who's claiming to be his cousin, and he wants to work with him on his oil field. And Plainview says to him at one point, you know, it's not enough that I succeed. Other people have to fail.
Yeah.
And I think that mentality describes only half of that mentality, because these people don't succeed. They are born losers. Like, despite, as you say, coming from wealthy backgrounds, their brother is a gazillionaire tech startup. They've got, you know, family members who are politicians or whatever, and they're the degenerate black sheep journalist who sticks his thumb up his behind and writes another PPP article about, well, gee golly, you know, it's really terrible what they're seeing on 4chan or Poll or Reddit. We really got to do something about this. But it selects for people who are vindictive and petty, basically nerds.
Yeah. Right?
It's nerds. It's people who should never have been let out of the locker that they were shoved into, and they have an axe to grind. And journalism has gone, again, the Jackson hypothesis or the Chesterton hypothesis. Maybe it never was this way, but it's gone from being a kind of noble, truth-seeking pursuit to just a way for low rent, low moral fiber, downwardly mobile people to pursue their vendettas against people who were like those who stuffed them in the lockers. Or very often they never even were put in the locker. They were just envious of the studly football player, the cheerleader, the naturally charming, cool person. You know, the old saying, high school never ends with journalism. That's one community where that holds true, because these are people who will never let their grudges go, right? And there's this one woman in The Guardian. I can't remember her name, but her articles are always clipped out and shared around Twitter. She's an Indian woman who's a journalist for The Guardian. And like half of her headlines are like, these guys wouldn't date me in high school, and now I'm bitter and old and alone, and it's still your fault. And it's just the same story over and over again.
Yeah, that goes into the narcissism of these people, and that it always seems like the different threads of journalism they pursue, in particular when it's kind of like Antifa, like, let me expose these people. It's always a well of their own insecurities. Like, you know, I have certain people out there that are obsessed with, like, you know, all types of like, I remember Michael Edison Hayden was saying that Spectre is some kind of gay porn star. He just made that up, or he took something out of context. And let's be honest, if you look at the things he writes and the things he talks about before becoming a journalist, it's very clear that he's the one that has confusion and issues about his sexuality. And the same with this guy who was saying, literally planted a rumor that I'm a Puerto Rican, which I'm fucking not. and then you look at stuff that he writes, and you see that he has a ton of insecurity about being mixed race. You know, again, I don't even hate the guy, frankly. I mean, I do to an extent because he tries to hurt people rather than just lash out in certain ways. But, you know, I almost feel sorry for these people because they're fueled entirely, not even by greed sometimes, but by their own personal demons and insecurities and so on. And when I read those studies that you cited in the book, I'm like, totally makes sense now. You know, this weird thing where you want to inflict pain or destroy someone's reputation or smear someone or make someone suffer, a person you've never met before, a person who is objectively weaker in society, who has less power than you, who is actually fighting the powerful. And you decide to work with the power to attack your own inner demons, your own traumas and your own complexes and so on. And I hate to get psychological, but, you know, just because we hate, you know, you talk about the disgust reflex later, but we'll talk about that later too. Just because talking about psychology, it activates my disgust reflex, doesn't mean that it's not true in some cases. The insecurity of certain people, I think the internet really brings that out, doesn't it?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I didn't know that about Hayden, and I don't want to talk too much about specific people.
Generate unnecessary conflict. It's not attention, but I think it's interested.
It's interesting. I didn't know that about him. And very often you see that the kinds of people who are the most mendacious are really fundamentally like first-rate victims of neoliberalism. Okay, yeah. You're from a rich family, and you're parents like basically neglected you, and maybe they had drug problems, and your mom divorced your dad and ran off with whoever, or there was abuse or violence or whatever the case was, or in the example that you used, you have this biracial, multiracial person, and there's a lot of psychological data that multiracial people struggle with unique psychological identity issues that are not seen in, say, less racially diverse individuals, right? And so these are basically people who are first-rate victims of neoliberalism, and they would make good soldiers, like convincing moral experiential case studies for why neoliberalism is evil. But they want to identify with the power structure. They're ultimately not noble people. You know, they are, you know, going to do an Aristotle reference. Let's leave the nerd stuff out of this. They're consumed by their own spirit to hurt, because they are low quality people. They are, I'm going
to
keep
repeating. Well, they want other people to feel like they do, but a lot of their problems are all in their heads. Like, I'm not, you know, I don't think people should have, obviously, my political beliefs, people should not be reproducing interracially at the very least. However, if someone is of mixed race ancestry, I don't personally hate them or want to harm them or anything like that, you know. And I think they kind of project their own self-hatred onto these acceptable targets, that the system kind of weaponizes their self-hatred towards the system's enemies, which is probably why they promote miscegenation so hard.
Resentment is a mineable resource. It will never expire. It will always exist, and it's something that you can just keep digging deeper into and finding ever more intense levels of vitriol to direct the other people. So I don't know if you've read. There's this great kind of like in the Marxist tradition, this Korean German guy Byung-Chul Han, and he talks about psychopolitics. As a development from Foucault, instead of being about like punishing people and the disciplinary style and making people self-conscious about their actions so that they're internally self-policing, neoliberalism succeeds by just basically accessing your psyche, accessing your deep emotions, your anxieties, your fears, your hopes, your resentments, and using that as a socioeconomic tool for its own advancement. So, right, I mean, that's right. What these people basically, that's what they're dealing with.
Right. That's what I try to tell people, is that just because I'm going to affirm my own, you know, as a person, a Western man, just because I'm going to affirm our people's dignity doesn't mean that I despise you personally or anything. You know, it doesn't mean that. Like, just because you might have a different identity or somewhat, so on. The way they're able to create straw men out of us, in conjunction with their psychological issues, creates a very dangerous situation where now we're hearing people on CNN talking about droning white men, using drones in the United States of America against American citizens, against right-wing white men. Like, that was something Nicole Wallace was talking about with a panel of Jews and like mixed race people. Like, no one said, hey, maybe we should rethink that. No, they all nodded in agreement.
Well, this is the thing I find so interesting is, you know, one of the, you know, we're both at the same age, you know, we could probably relate to this. My experience of growing up in a liberal, neoliberal society is that there's an intense hang up around violence.
Yeah.
There's an intense hang up around negative emotions like hatred. I mean, the whole mantra of our political opposition is these people hate and we love, right? It's this very childlike, naive, underdeveloped view of things. And if things have turned on a dime so quickly where, I mean, you can't let kids duke it out in the schoolyard. If they're in elementary school, you have to make football safer. You have to remove violence and physical confrontation. Words are violence. Your silence is violence. You have to remove all these confrontations from society. And that's good. It's noble. It's enlightened. It's liberal. And the moment that these people feel pressure. So there's one guy I reference very heavily in the book, Zach Goldberg. He's doing a PhD, I think, at some school in Georgia, and he calls his thesis is wokeness studies. And Steve Saylor has written about this. 2011, 2012 is where you see this sharp uptick in the use of extreme progressive woke language in the New York Times, MSNBC, CNN, all of these mainstream corporate institutions. And it's all about instigating violence, marginalizing the majority, denigrating the kind of heritage Americans. And that escalated. And then with BLM 2013, 2014, when those cops were shot in Houston, you know, you have all this justification of the violence. And then obviously with Trump, that has brought us to this point where it is, you know, totally Schmidtian. It is totally justifiable and good to just kill random people who may look like those guys you're afraid of. So there's just this total flip on the violence question that I find very, very interesting.
Yeah. You know, there's also another guy, I don't know if you've heard of him, his name's Rob Henderson. And he's a PhD candidate, and I don't think he has any books, but he's written articles before. And he's written a ton of material on what he calls luxury beliefs. And he says, and this goes back to the psychotic element of our elites, and that a lot of the beliefs that are considered high status, that only the top, say, 5 or 10% wealthiest and most powerful believe in, like, say, abolishing the police or open borders or destroying the family, he says that these are actually fueled by a kind of subconscious, and I think in the case of many Jews, conscious feeling of wanting to harm lower class people and make them even weaker so that they can't fight against you when you fuck up. So, for example, he brings up the point of polyamory. He says that at, I think he went to Yale or Harvard. He says that when he was at Harvard, he would go on Tinder and look up, like, within a mile or two, all Harvard students or Ivy League students. And he said every profile of a woman would say that she was polyamorous, ethically non-monogamous. And then he said he would expand the search radius to 10 miles, and it was nothing but single mothers. So what he was saying is these are two manifestations of the same luxury belief, that when the lower classes adapt the beliefs of the upper classes, they suffer because they don't have the money, the legal resources, the social and familial stability and so on to survive these negative habits like polyamory and so on, while lower class people end up suffering deeply from that. They're kind of sheltered from the downsides of these trends and fads and antisocial. What do you call it? You call America an anti-society. And I think this is absolutely a trickle down of elites pissing from the top and the piss landing and puddling up here at the bottom. What do you think?
You know, that's really interesting. I got it. That's something I've never heard of Henderson or this idea, but that's something that
He has a great story, by the way. This guy was, his mother was a drug addict. I think he's like, you know, he's probably not entirely white, but his mother was a drug addict. His father died or something. He grew up in a foster home, and then he joined the military. And then he somehow got his way into Ivy League schools through merit. The military is probably the last merit, or was the last merit-based institution where you can make something of yourself. That seems to be ending now. But yeah, that's his background story. It's very interesting.
I mean, I think it's obviously true. And that the idea of the luxury belief, I've never put it in those words, but that's something that Jefferson and I have talked about for a very long time, that these are just, you can only uphold that lifestyle if you're ensconced in wealth and just all of the, you know, legal resources. You can just float from one cloud to the next. It's very true.
I mean, even crossing racial boundaries. I mean, look at the impact of the sexual revolution on those 1960s well-connected, wealthy parents, college, mostly white and Jewish college students, versus the impact the sexual revolution has on, say, the black community, right? Totally different results. For some, they fucked around for a couple of years. They got treatment for their STDs, and they had birth control pills that they could access. For blacks, they just have a bunch of kids out of wedlock, and now you're starting to see kind of working-class whites and even middle-class whites starting to suffer from the problem of having kids out of wedlock. Now, that's not to say that that's some kind of ultimate evil. I'm not a Puritan, but I am saying that these are social consequences that are created by elites coming to a decision on what's going to be cool and how it actually affects the lives of everyday people, you know?
Well, they're taking something which would have been a cautionary tale and would have affected a very small percentage of people, and there would have actually have been community solutions to those kinds of issues. And they've just stretched that out as a model for everybody to follow. So,
They take down the gates that used to kind of police that stuff, and they take them down for everybody, not just themselves.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk about, let me just read a little passage that I liked from your book. So this is from I believe the second chapter. Basically what I think you're talking about here is that you say, you know, I think this is basically about, like, correct me if I'm wrong, various like modern or trauma-centered treatments that are proposed by psychology and psychiatry are essentially self-evident failures because there are more crazy people now than ever before in history. Is that a correct take on what you're saying?
Yeah. Well, I mean, what is it? 1 in 4 women are on antidepressants. I remember when I read this study, this was 2015 or 2016, the life expectancy of white women had begun to decline for the first time, I think, in modern history. And this was around 2015, wow. 2016. So you're talking about the most effective, I don't want to go lean into the MGTOW thing too hard, but you could say the most privileged group of people, or one of them anyway, in America, very well off, lots of resources devoted to them, have all of these resources and they're blasting their brains on SSRIs. And the life expectancy, which was previously at like I don't know, 76 or something, it dropped by a year and a half, 2 years, 3 years. So that should really be startling. That should really, really be something that's like, whoa, okay, something is really going wrong here. What are the treatments that are out there? It's all of, basically they're all like liberalized, pseudo medical interventions, drugs, which really don't have any empirical data to support their efficacy, and there's even like maybe philosophical points or actual scientific points about, do we even know what they're actually doing in the brain? Can we even prove that they're having the effects that we're claiming that they're having? You have something like some cognitive behavioral therapy, which again is like the whole view of the methodology is that this is your problem. Well, it's your thoughts, and you just have to turn down the volume on the bad thoughts and turn up the volume on the good thoughts. And you just need to create habits, as if any of these things happen in isolation, as if it is solely the individual who is suffering that is the point of origin, the genesis for these problems. They are always communal. I've had dozens of clients where they come in, and I straight up told them, I was like, listen, your problem is everybody around you. You're a wonderful person. if this were some like fantasy novel and I was a rich person, I would lift you up out of poverty and just like, you hear those stories about like the white CEO who gives the job to the brown janitor or whatever. And now they're CEO or whatever. It's like, I would do that for you because you're a wonderful person. And they just tell you the story about, yeah, like my uncle beats me and this person stole my money and that person fucking, he fucked my wife and blah, 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 blah. And it's like, oh, there's everyone around you that's crazy. You're just the one cursed with like a head on your shoulders that works right. So you have all these modalities that are fundamentally putting the individual as the locus of where these problems are starting. And it's, again, to use kind of a Foucauldian idea, there's an idea that a strategy of neoliberal governance is responsibilizing the individual. It's all on you. Think about the COVID response. Well, it's all about how you can stop the spread. Like, yeah. How about down the airlines? How about doing anything that would have worked? No, it's the individual who has to solve
the problem. Right. Well, one thing I'll disagree with you somewhat about women being privileged, and I can see how one could perceive that, but I think a good comparison would be like, imagine being a parent that leaves their 8-year-old in the house alone for a month, and the 8-year-old is eating ice cream for dinner. They're playing with knives. They're running with scissors. They're, you know, and that's not to say, I know it sounds like I'm saying all women are children. They aren't. But I think a lot of the, what looks like, privileges that women enjoy are actually kind of a poor stand-in for the influence of a strong man. And it's not women's fault, because the system has engineered men to not be strong anymore. So they don't have a woman that doesn't have a rock to rely on. You know, I always look at like great women that I've known. They've always had solid dads. You know, that's like a cliche at this point. They've always had great dads. They always have, a strong foundation of what a man is supposed to look like, right? And I think that a lot of cultural novelties that have occurred, like no-fault divorce, that have been made almost the norm, that these things are having a psychological impact on them. And the Jews basically have, it's like, oh, you're feeling crazy? Well, here's some stuff that'll make you crazier. That'll actually validate your craziness. It's like saying, like, it's like sculpting a phony world so that a schizophrenic feels at home. And I would actually say that's not a privilege, because it's harming the person. And I would argue that the studies that I've seen that show that liberals have higher rates, I'm not sure if this is in your book, but they have higher rates of mental illness.
Yeah. Actually, it's interesting to that point. Yeah. There was about 10 years ago. Sorry to cut you off. But 10 years ago, there was a very famous headline that was published. Conservatives more psychotic than liberals. And then they had to issue a retraction about a year and a half later because somehow the guys who published that finding got it reversed. And everything that has ever been done in terms of psychometrics shows liberals higher levels of neuroticism. And it goes with a certain, if you want to go all Jordan Peterson, like there's a certain five-factor model way of looking at the left-right dichotomy as a biological reality, which is liberals, left people tend to be more open-minded, a higher trait openness, higher in trait neuroticism, lower in conscientiousness, basically meaning they're more anxious, they're more exploratory, they're less fastidious about rules and orderliness. And then the conservative is opposite. They're very highly extroverted, relatively not open-minded, more on the closed side of things, and very low neuroticism. So, and also healthier physical profiles for men, more testosterone, more flattering physiques, things like that, even naturally. But look, I don't want to lean too heavily on the white woman thing. The only point I was really trying to make is that you look at a group that ostensibly there's a perception of thriving and is on the decline. And that should be an indication that things are going in a very bad direction.
And there can't be an explanation for it other than they're doing it on purpose. I mean, that's another thing that I think is important. But, you know, I find that a lot of practices that left-leaning people partake in, lifestyle choices, attitudes towards things, the cues they get from higher, like the myth makers, the clergy of the liberal myth, that what they prescribe to them is going to create mental illness, even in places where it doesn't exist, or someone's on the fence. And, you know, you look at all these anarchists, and the further left you go, when it comes to the cultural left, the more unstable and crazy the person is. I mean, I was looking at one of these famous anarchists, like two famous Antifa people, Hillary Sargent and Molly Conger, and they look insane. They look insane and they act insane, and they're always talking about their struggles with mental illness. However, I will say this about, quote, conservatives. You do sear them in the book, which is great. And let me just be really vulgar and nasty for a second. American politics, the left versus right in American politics, because of the warped, dysfunctional first principles of liberalism, it's essentially two pussies scissoring with each other. No one wants to fuck. And so what's happening now is that leftists are doing a transgender female-to-male surgery, and one of them now has a fake cock and is fucking this country because it's impossible to run a country without someone being the dominant force. There's no such thing as live, let live in nature, in politics, or otherwise. And I think that this is something that now they're attaching the fake tranny penis. And now we got two choices: lube your butthole up or stand and fight. And I think that, yeah. Now I'll close that vulgar little comparison and let you talk about the institutional right from a psychological perspective.
Well, that was very vulgar. So Patrick. Yeah. Well, look, again, I was writing this to reach the widest audience possible, and I didn't want anyone reading it to get the impression that I was partisan. Obviously I am, right? Like, the great liberal fallacy is that you can be nonpartisan. I'm partisan. I'm just not a liberal partisan. And the important thing to understand, and this is less obvious, I think, especially for right-wing people, is the degree to which institutional conservatism is extreme. And if you don't believe that, look at what the Republican Party is doing to shred the third round of COVID relief. Right? Okay. We were going to get $2,000, now it's $1,400. Well, we want $1,000, and it's only for people who earn below 50 grand. We want to do it in installments. Right? We're dealing with this, however you feel about COVID, plandemic, pandemic, whatever. We're going on to almost a full calendar year where people have been suffering. suffering, dying for reasons COVID related, non-COVID related. The just wellness or well-being of the average American has steeply declined. People have lost a year of their lives, and it was totally avoidable. And it was the conservative instinct in the very beginning, in a borderline way, oscillating between, well, this is a liberal ploy versus it's a Chinese weaponized virus to take out of the American economy, to masks, you're a cuck if you wear a mask, to now to do some kind of Dinesh D'Souza, like we're the real mask wearers. Like institutional conservatism is extreme in the way that it encourages these social and economic practices that erode trust and erode health, erode the community and the family. I mean, under Trump, one of his big initiatives was this, I don't remember the name of it, but he was expanding, what the hell was it actually about? Basically, he was trying to fund more women going into the corporate world and advancing.
Yes, I remember that.
He's trying to do that internationally. And it's like, look, the whole way in which we're permitted to talk about these difficult issues is set up in such a way that you can never reach a sane conclusion. So, I mean, this is something Mark Brahman, Mark Brahman always says, is the Caducean phenomenon. You have a set up framework where the ball is always going back on either sides of the wall, and both sides are there just to keep the ball in play, but never do anything about it. So if we wanted to talk about, say, for example, the prosperity of women or women's labor, not in the sense of giving birth, but their economic power, if we wanted to talk about women's ability to be creative, blah, blah, blah. Well, we can only talk about it in terms of, are there enough women CEOs of Raytheon? Are there enough, women law enforcement officers? It's you can't talk about a real issue, which we could move forward in a genuinely progressive way. No, we have to deal with the extremist conservative position, and we have to deal with the extremist liberal position.
Yeah. And it's like the only people that exist in this country are the top million wealthiest. You see that phenomenon in Hollywood. Like, you don't actually see ordinary people and their day-to-day struggles in movies. You usually see Brad Pitt, the movie credits roll, and it's Brad Pitt jogging outside of his multi-million dollar home in California. And then he's like a spy or like some... He's like some other kind of elite identity. It's like, what about the struggles of everyday people? Like, in my youth in New York, and I'm sure yours too, I have some interesting stories to tell too, I mean, and mine probably aren't even in the top of interesting stories. And yet, those kinds of stories are never told. It's always some kind of niche interest, and that is used to create one, an archetype, and two, it's also used to forbid people from being able to look at themselves in the mirror, get a grasp of who they are, and then engage in collective action based on that. They're afraid of new identities or constructive identities being created in the minds of the common man. So we have a society right now where, like, I have to go on Twitter debating with people for why McDonald's and Walmart should pay a living wage, only because their minds have been warped with Hollywood movies that tell them that they are simply temporarily embarrassed billionaires that one day could be suffered. So they see themselves more, despite being a pleb, they see themselves more as the Wall Street hedge fund guy than they do the actual pleb they are, and I think this comes from self-actualization. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's I just read the Repeater Books just released the last lectures that Mark Fisher did before he killed himself, and he has this definition of petite bourgeois, which I very briefly dated this Ukrainian woman like a while back, and And I was telling her, like, yeah, I'm going to work real hard, and one day I'll be a millionaire. She's just looking at me because she's a little bit old. She was about my age, and she was Russian, grew up under the Soviet regime. She's like, you stupid American, like, you think your work is actually going to get you somewhere? Like, what's wrong with you? And I couldn't understand her. I was like, what's wrong with this broad? This is America. And Fisher has this definition of the petit bourgeois, which is literally the bootstrapism. Like, I'm just going to show up at work half an hour early, and I'm not going to take my lunch break. I'm going to stay a half hour late. I'm going to email my boss my great ideas, and one day I'll be in charge. It's like, that doesn't happen.
No,
This doesn't happen.
I was just looking at, someone sent me a statement that they copied from LinkedIn. They sent me a screenshot, and it was a LinkedIn of a pretty high up CEO at Amazon. And he's a guy maybe in his 30s or something, 30s or 40s. And he said that the way he was able to get a job high up at Amazon was that his father met the new CEO, Jassy, at a Rosh Hashanah dinner. So he went there and he goes, "My son needs a job. Get him a, can I get him a job at Amazon? He's looking for work." And the guy said, "Sure." So what I'd say to bootstrappers out there is, show me how I can walk into a Rosh Hashanah dinner and shake the boss's hand and get a job. Describe this to me. So yes, I totally agree with what you're saying. Now let's talk about another pertinent thing before we go on to the questions here. You write this in the book. It said, "Seen in this light, mental illness can be understood as a result of a conflict between dysgenic mythos and natural psychological tendencies, which seek realization within an orderly mental and cultural framework." What do you mean by that?
Yeah, what did I mean by that? This is the thing. I mean, Borzo, you guys both write. I mean, I literally, it's like once the word processor closes, like, it's just brain dead.
Dude,
I
I don't even remember anything I talked about on a show 10 minutes after I do it.
Me neither. Yeah. I think, yeah, go
I
ahead.
think so. Yeah, I mean, basically, you have what it was. So I just read Julian Jaynes, and he got this great book from the 70s. I think it's only the only book he ever published, The Bicameral Mind. And his hypothesis basically is, you go back far enough, there's a time in prehistory where there's no such thing as subjectivity. And the thoughts in your head are not your thoughts, they're the thoughts of the deity that your tribe worshipped. And he told you to do things. And it was just a divine commandment, like strike of lightning bolt hits you, you're thunderstruck, and you go out and you do the thing, whatever the thing is, and you never reflect on it. And you never question it. And you just go out. And if it's Apollo, if it's Wotan, if it's whoever, they're telling you what to do, and you fucking do it. And that was over time, you start to write these things down, and then they become metaphoric and mythical, and they become, you're detached from, like, the experiential thing. And eventually you get to a point where, like, the gods become, especially in pantheistic cultures, embodiments of certain psychological types: the god of war, the goddess of love, the god
Oh.
of trickery, this thing, that, the other thing. And the gods represent, in a certain sense, psychological aptitudes, tendencies, and you pray to that god for that particular attribute to manifest for you. And so you have these stories, and the stories are directing you into a particular mode of conduct, into a particular set of ethics. And there's, if you're praying to Dionysus, you're probably going to be a lush and a layabout and maybe kind of a slut. Right, those are aptitudes.
Yeah.
Those are aptitudes. It's again, use another Jamesian word. It's aptic. It's an
Yeah.
aptic tendency in the brain. And if that's what you're worshiping, those are the things that are going to come out, and those are the things you're going to pursue. Those will be the people you associate with. That's what becomes your object of worship. So you have all of these aptitudes, and the kind of God that you worship, the deity, whatever the ideal that you have. This is like why it's laughable when you think about the new atheists or any of these rationalists, and they're like, "Oh, we have our reason." Okay, well, you're still kind of worshiping logos, dude. Like, it's the same thing. You just took all of the meaning out of it. You just like squeezed it dry of all of the richness, and now you've just got this gay voice in your head that's your own, but what is it really giving you? Everything else is falling apart around you. So what is mental illness? It's like you're worshiping the wrong gods.
Yeah,
you're worshiping the wrong ideals. It's the embodied deity is something that's twisted and evil.
Yeah.
I think that's what I meant.
You look at some of these people, like, again, we're constantly harping, but it's tons of personality types. But you look at the typical, like, just go to the Libertarian convention, right? The Libertarian Party convention. And you're going to have, like, dudes with, like, you know, dressed in weird costumes and running around naked. And it's like a political convention. And you just see this with that kind of hyper analytical, hyper individualist, you know, I don't need no man type of philosophy that both men and women seem to be in the libertarian sphere and the leftist sphere and so on. No respect for hierarchy. And I don't mean that in the fetishized libertarian way, but hierarchy as in God, man, woman, child, that kind of hierarchy, you know. When you break that order, that logos, out of life, you amputate it out of the hearts and minds of people, what's left is all these aspects of your mind that start to overgrow your brain like weeds. Because there's no life in your brain. There's no logos in your brain. You can say, again, E. Michael Jones kind of popularized that term in these circles, but there's a logos before Christianity as well. Of course, it's a Greek term. Not to say that Christianity can't be a form of logos. I think it can be. I just don't think it's the only logos. And when you don't have this idea of a legitimate authority of any kind, which you go into in your book, you just fucking snap. You just snap. Well, what is, if there's no legitimate authority, there can't be order. And if there's no order, why can't I just go on the on the subway and start jerking off? Why can't I just go and dress up like Smokey the Bear and get fisted at the next furry convention? Like, this is the life without logos in a nutshell. It leads to psychotic behaviors, insanity, mental illness. And on top of that, we live in a system, thanks to Ronald Reagan, where the people that have mental illness don't even get the treatment they need. You go to New York City sometime. Anyone here that's from the place called America between California and New York, go visit New York City or California sometime, and you will see tons of mentally ill people seeming to outnumber the people who aren't mentally ill. And this is the model of the New World Order. This is the New World Order citizen, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, New York right now is just, there's just crazy homeless people everywhere.
It's insane.
Yeah.
But one good thing, though, is that now they're, because notice one last thing before we go, notice how the elites themselves always keep a foot in the door with logos. For example, the New York Metropolitan Museum of Art is possibly the greatest museum, the greatest art museum on the planet. You go and you see the New York Philharmonic is fantastic. You go and various other things like that. You see it in London. You see it in New York. So the elites, and this is something that is preserved for elites, right? Average people don't necessarily have access to something like that. And it's by design. So the elites, when they're feeling a little crazy, they go and they bask in logos, they bask in order, and not to mention also that they themselves have very strong ethnic communities themselves. If you're Jewish in New York City and you're starting to feel a little crazy or you're starting to feel a little down, all you got to do is take a plane trip to Israel and find a nationalist logos in a twisted way, logos centered racial state where normal values are championed to a degree. And then you can come back after you recharge your batteries to New York to piss and shit on everything again. So I think that this is a kind of also an inequality of access to order, of access to beautiful things, an inequality of transcendence, is another kind of quiet crisis in America that is leading to some of the mental illness, is it not?
Yeah, look, I mean, the other thing too is health is intimately tied to beauty. I don't know if I believe this, but I read a study a while back that linked intelligence and physical attractiveness together. I don't know how true that is. I haven't read a lot of other things about
it. I must be really, really intelligent.
Yeah, me too. But I mean, look, if everything around you is ugly, you're going to feel unwell. And again, it's this very myopic, individualistic thing that your environment doesn't matter, right? It's just about your frame of mind, like this kind of backward stoicism where it's just, if you just plug out the things you can't control, then everything will be okay. You need beauty to thrive. You need beauty to have wellness, and whether that's beautiful women, beautiful architecture, beautiful music, we don't have any of those things. No. You look around, and especially in New York, it's incredibly, increasingly oppressive, just based on the, well, just if the street is in a state of disrepair,
right?
That's ugly, right. And that's going to hurt you.
Yeah, if there's trash everywhere, heroin needles, stuff like that. I mean, that's kind of, it goes back to, it almost intersects with the broken glass theory, right? That when you start seeing a little bit of disorder, graffiti, broken windows, not broken glass, broken windows theory, that this encourages you to add to the disorder. And you know, it's funny, we're all guilty. Because when one, you know, if you visit an orderly part of America and then you go to New York City, suddenly you start feeling a little looser, you know, and I've noticed that even in myself. So, you know, for example, when I lived in Germany many years ago, you people didn't even, including in Munich, didn't even toss cigarettes on the sidewalk. It was seen as littering. So you would have to smoke your cigarette, put it out, and then toss it in the many, many public ashtrays and garbage bins. In New York, you see people, and again, this is partially because of race, but it's also the environment and the climate. These two things are interconnected too. You know, you'll see some black dude eating McDonald's and then roll up his McDonald's bag and just toss it on the street. You know,
that station right now looks like a homeless camp. There's just food and fecal matter just across the path. You go onto the whatever train you're taking, Long Island Railroad, whatever, Metro North, and depending what part of 34th Street or Penn Station, inside Penn Station you're at, and they just renovated the whole thing. They're trying to make it look good, and then you just walk 100 feet to the left, and there's just like beer bottles and Burger King wrappers and things, and it's just there all day. All day, every day. I don't know how you could stay sane in an environment like that. And if you're a creative, aspirational person, how can you work to create beautiful things if there's just despondency and despotism everywhere you look?
Yeah, yeah. And crime. Don't forget crime. I mean, that obviously has a psychological effect on you in increasing your anxiety, increasing your things like that, and Jews always have a kind of route to pool these feelings into a direction that they like. So, you know, if you're still living in New York City, you're lonely, except for the criminals who are shooting. Like, I mean, there's tons of hipsters that are getting like stabbed and shot and stuff in New York right now. I don't want to, you know, express any Schadenfreude on that, but you kind of have to sit back and say, this is the world you helped create. This is the world you create journalism for, you create art for, you create music for. It's all this mindset of, oh, I miss the old New York, says little Molly from Iowa. I miss the old New York. Well, now you have the old New York. Oh, you don't want to live there anymore. Okay. Well, just I mean, this is the problem, right?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, you raised that point, and I was talking with a friend about this the other day. New York is the home for the homeless. Now, whether we're talking about the actual vagrants on the street, or you're talking about the people, Daisy, Susie from Wisconsin, who moves to New York with some idealized image, and she's leaving because she hates Wisconsin, and she hates the people that she grew up with, and she hates the lack of excitement and titillation that isn't there, and she comes to New York, and the degradation is New York to them. That's what's cool. Isn't it really great that this guy is pissing in the street as he steps out of the cab? Man, that's so New York. It's like, that's not fucking what, there are no New Yorkers left in New York. There's the transplants and the drug addicts, and that's basically it. And so, like, why would anyone take care of anything? Why would anyone care about the fast food tray, as you step off the 6th train? Why would anyone care that you can't afford anything? Why would anyone care that you could watch a woman get raped down an alley and no one's going to stop? Why would you care about any of these things happening? That a guy gets pushed in front of a train, killed instantaneously. And this happens, or there was a period, late last year, early this year, where that was happening with alarming regularity.
Yeah.
Nobody does anything about it. That's New York, man. Well, that's just, look, so I can live this fantasy life where I'm the actor, the lead actress in my own movie. Well, you just got to deal with the vagrants, and you got to deal with the, death by rail. Like, that's just life, man. Take the good with the bad.
Yeah, and you know what it is too, Josh, is that you and I come from a similar background, like kind of like working class, middle class, white New Yorkers, from Queens and shit. We have a similar background, and it seems like your generation and mine are almost like the last dinosaurs of that kind of New York lifestyle or heritage or something. Very far. I mean, I can't tell you how many Nazis grew up within a mile of me. I won't give any details, but there's tons of really famous white nationalists that grew up very close to where I grew up in a place that was like 20% white. And I think that all that entire generation of men that I grew up with, they're gone. Nowhere in sight. Like, just they left. And with good reason. I mean, what do you think? What do you think of that in general? That is that having an impact on lifestyles in New York?
Put it this way: long before I knew you personally, I knew where you were from, proximity leads to radicalization. People who want to get bent out of shape about optics or reaching normies or messaging—it's like, why do the most radical people come from urban areas? Because all you need to do is look around you, and it's just a matter of time. It's the hour, you flip the hourglass upside down, and you can just count the beads of sand until this person becomes a fringe radical, a diehard fanatic, and they will be that way for life. Nothing will ever change that person because it's not like these whacked out, like, reformed racists or reformed anti-Semites who come out and say, well, gee golly, I was a white nationalist, or I was a this, that, the other thing. And I had the wrong views, and now I think differently. It's like, they weren't lifers. They weren't lifers because they didn't have those kinds of experiences that totally transform who you are as a person. And again, to the point you're saying earlier, it's not about transforming you into a hateful person, into a misogynist or an anti-Semite or a racist or a homophobe or this, that, or the other thing. Maybe that happens, maybe it doesn't, not the point. It's about transforming you into someone who craves beauty, who craves dignity, who craves truth and honor, wants to live a meaningful life, wants to die a meaningful death, and that is the kind of person they become, because you don't have that around you. And certainly for us, to the point you were making.
Yeah, I mean, when I was growing up in Queens, you could go to a random white guy, and like talk about literally the things we're talking about, maybe not to on the same level, but you just talk about like race and politics and stuff, and totally on the same frequency as us. You go to certain other parts of the country. Like, if I go to like Boise, Idaho, and I start opening like those kinds of conversations up with a dude at the bar, there's a chance that someone is going to say that and agree and talk to me about it. But there's also a huge chance that the guy's like, I don't want to talk about this topic. And why? It's because that guy's never been the only white man on a bus. He's never been, jumped by 10 blacks. He's never been having to read signs in Chinese. You know, this is totally.
He never had to watch his neighborhood turn into either some kind of capitalist hellscape or be totally overtaken by a different ethnic enclave.
Well, I mean,
literally, I go back to the neighborhood I grew up in. It is.
Yeah.
The people are not the same. Nothing is the same.
Oh, no. I know that neighborhood too. And it's fucking changed dramatically in the last 10 years. My mother, like I've told this story before, but my mother, who's the sweetest woman, never hurt a soul in her life. Sweetest woman who is my heart and my soul. She was walking down the street once. She's a tiny woman. She weighs 100 pounds, and some black did the knockout game with her. And you know what's funny? She didn't even go down. But that's when you've experienced things like that. Like, you know, it gets to the point where it's so much, so many things, that you just stop getting personally mad about it, and you start saying, how do I think about this in a systematic fashion so I can take this whole fucking system down? And I think that's how you and I approach these things. Like, I'm not personally mad. I mean, I am personally mad in cases like that, but I don't personalize my anger, and I don't let resentment overwhelm me on these things. But, when you have so many experiences, you see, like, I mean, you see this with another guy who grew up not too far from me in my neighborhood, Robert Rundo. You know, you see his experiences, and that's one of the hardest fucking hardcore guys who you cannot break this man's faith. And he has the world after him, and he doesn't give a shit. You know, it just hardens you to a point without making you petty or resentful and so on. You start seeing this evil system in 2020 vision, right? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, again, thinking of those people who were like, they were crazy racists or whatever. Those are the people who personalized it. Oh, it was that black guy when I was in high school, or it was that Jewish person or that gay person. And it becomes not about the idea. It's not a world philosophy. It's not a feeling towards what life should be like. It's about, oh, this guy who screwed me one time. And that becomes, that's the kind of person I talk about in the book, the idiophile, where you take one idea, one experience, one sentiment, and you stretch it until it snaps. And you can't make worldview out of that. You can't do radical politics with that. You can't make beautiful art. You can't make a family out of that. Nothing good comes from that fundamental position.
Right. Yes, I think that the ultimate response is to do exactly what we're doing, which is create an intellectual foundation for fighting this system, and also a moral high ground. We have to build a moral high ground and moral confidence, because without that, people are not willing to sacrifice themselves. It's only through a moral truth that humans are willing to sacrifice themselves, which is why our myths make it so that there is no moral truth other than racism and white people are bad. That's the only moral truth. It's the Holocaust, racism is evil, and white people are evil. And that's the only thing that motivates people in this society, where you are expected, by the way, by the system, to kill and die in the interest of fighting racism or fascism or all these other isms that the Zionists are using to disenfranchise white working people, to try potentially to jail and kill us all. Who the hell knows? Anything goes in the name of stopping, quote, racism. So, yeah, let's get to the questions. You there, boys?
Okay, let's do it. So, we got here. Pepe Cells. How much was that? I don't see the number on there. $5. Pepe Cells donates $5. Guys, thanks for bringing TPS back. And it's great to see Josh here. Question for Stryker. Did you Spend your second stimulus check on new rims for the wheelchair.
I haven't got my stimulus check yet. I don't know. Are people getting them? Or did you get yours, Borzoi?
Is this the $1,400 one? I think right now they're at the stage of Biden still totally. I am not cutting. I am not going any lower than $1,400 and presenting as though that he was always for $1,400, not for $2,000. So they're already starting to bring us down to $500. But of course, it's just $200, and you get $50, Goyim.
Yeah, well, I never got the $600 either yet, so I don't know if are those supposed to come out.
If you didn't get your $600, you might need to look into the IRS website and see how you can get it if you're eligible for it.
Yeah,
well, I definitely am. I think what they're doing is that they're mailing. They for some reason they mail mine. I'll have to look into it, but yeah, no, haven't bought new rims yet. So there's that question answered.
QAnon donates $6. How's NJP going? Really moralizing to see real action.
Yes, NJP is going fantastic. We keep building on events to simply start building a culture, a community. You know, tons of I don't want to go into detail, but there's tons of good stuff when you show up real life of people doing various different constructive projects, and it just hooks people up. It's like we're at the networking stage right now, and it's very, very productive. So lots of stuff. Again, it's not for the public because, of course, when you're developing a political project, you know, I fucking hate this right-wing obsession with, hey, if we have a disagreement or if we have a project or if we want to build something, let's make sure we do it out in public so that the SPLC and the FBI and various Zionist trolls can also have input. You know, so we're avoiding that and building it up slowly but surely. Good stuff going on.
All right. Sina Wolf, Kina Wolf, Kine Wolf, I don't know how you pronounce it. Donates $10. Great stream, lads. Have some Zogbucks.
Ah, thank you, sir.
Vito Grappa donates $4.88. Hello, fellow Duganists. Just passing on this $4.88 as Mr. Dugan specified. Nazbol Gang Gang.
Oh, thank you, and thank you to. I don't even want to joke like that right now. Because you know how things are in this country.
Yeah, but I think the Dugan memes pretty much died off completely.
It has. They seem to have moved on. The last I saw of it was the SPLC was accusing me of being an FSB agent, which is fucking just, I mean, it just shows you how retarded. I don't know, Borzoi, did you see the article I did on their hate map?
I knew they had a hate map. I didn't know anything about it. That's actually funny that they're accusing me of FSB. I mean, I'm the only one, I believe I'm the only one on this stream that actually has Russian ancestry.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look at my article on National-Justice. Where I look at the SPLC's 2020 hate map. It was just released this week. It's actually ridiculous. Like, for example, they say that the National Socialist German Workers' Party has a chapter in Lincoln, Nebraska. Now, most of us thought that the NSDAP went defunct in 1945. But according to the SPLC, a guy that runs a bookstore that sells Third Reich memorabilia actually also runs a chapter of the NSDAP in the cornfields of Nebraska.
Well, you see what happened, Stryker. Here's what happened was that some of the guys who escaped through the rat lines to Argentina, eventually their grandsons who they educated in the ways of the NSDAP, illegally immigrated up to the United States to do farm work, and they're opening up a new chapter starting there.
Yeah, interesting.
I guess moving on over to, over here. I can't remember if I did this one or not, because it was right at the end, so I'll just read it just in case. BixDude donated $1 last week. Now that GME stock is weaponized, it's more important than ever to rid Benjamin Franklin of the anti-gamer smear.
Oh,
I don't
What's that about?
He was doing a couple different memes because around the last week was when I basically people had brought up some in the comments that Benjamin Franklin had made about Germans that were perceived to be anti-German.
Oh.
And I've done a lot of work into that. Basically, those quotes are taken vastly out of context.
It's still funny to imagine him being some kind of like outrageous purity spiraler.
Yeah.
Like, oh yes, the Swedes are too swarthy for America. Like, just imagining that, it just cracks me up.
Well, what cracks me up is that people who know that Franklin was known for having a very irreverent sense of humor. He was like, he loved to have jokes. That suddenly he's very deadly serious. That he's 1488 Spurg who only considers the Anglo as white. Is like, no, no.
Right. Well, the little detour I'll do on this is that, like, people that you're kind of allowed to be an extremely to have a very narrow definition of your in-group, like not on a national level, but for example, take like someone that's like, oh, I just believe that the population of the Isle of Man is white, and those, so that's my white nationalism. Like, Jews will not really bother you that much if you do that. Then the other extreme is anyone can be white, or anyone can be a European, a German, or a Frenchman, or something. That's the other extreme you won't get bothered for, you'll be supported for. But if you take the middle position, which says, let's unite all people of European descent against this liberal Zionist system, that's that sweet spot that will get you some bad attention in America, you know? That's what I think. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
All right, moving on to the next one. Tam donates $30. Thank you, Tam.
Thank you very much, Tam.
Rafael Trujillo donates $3. Things are very screwed for them. Falling total fertility rate means they can only push the white percentage down through immigration. Falling TFF in other countries means a shrinking non-African migrant population.
Huh. Yeah, I mean, there is something to that. I've always kind of disagreed with Malthusian logic about populations and so on. But I think the explosion in the African population is very concerning for the future of the world.
A lot of that is, we know a lot of that is due to a combination of advances, but also a lot of it is literally engineered. I mean, they've boosted those numbers up intentionally.
Yes, yes. And, you know, I don't want to sit here and be – I think there's always something ghoulish about – and also there's nothing you can do about it. But there's always something very ghoulish about, like, oh, how do we cull this population? How do we do this and that? I don't like to engage in that kind of discourse. But with that said, this is a problem that's going to require very, very tall walls in Europe in particular. I think that as – there's also a potential though that as liberalism declines, these people as they get closer to China, the Chinese will probably be like, okay, blacks can only have two babies each, and their populations will fall in places like Nigeria and stuff, because the Chinese are increasingly the main players in Africa, and it's actually good because unlike the Judeo-liberal West, the Chinese don't want a world where, you know, black Africans outnumber them. And maybe they'll figure that out. Who knows?
All right. Glenn the Chinaman donates $3. Borzoi, loved your piece. And on the third rail, did you know Tokyo and Osaka have booming population while the rest of Japan is shrinking? Cities are getting more densely populated as population falls. Also, farmland is being bought up by multinationals. That's so you might not know completely what he's referring to, Stryker, but I did a piece on the last third rail about ghost towns that are emerging across the world. But the ground zero that you're seeing for that is is Japan, where you just have completely abandoned houses that are, you know, it's almost like Detroit level, but with less of the causes and decay that's involved with all that. But something you're seeing is that you do have these billionaires and multinational corporations that are interested in buying up all these farmlands and rural areas as more and more people are moving into cities. But what that also means for people of our disposition is both on in collapsed urban cities, but also the collapsed rural countryside. It's just it's ripe for people to engage in their own reclamation projects for it. The one place we're going to have trouble with is going to be the suburbs.
Well,
because the problem, where they're the moving away have, power sources.
Yeah, the problem I have with back to the land type of stuff is that ultimately power, even in decaying, empty ghost cities and so on, the power is still going to be decided there. Like, you know, the capital cities decide the policy in the countryside, and that's kind of what the tension and antagonism that's causing a lot of that is being caused by this power differential, which is why you see a growing yawning gap between rural and urban. Now, the problem is that if we don't have a presence in urban enclaves, or at least close to urban enclaves, and I'm not saying this is realistic for everyone, like if you have a family, yeah, you can't live in most cities, but if you're kind of like a single activist, or you just kind of have, you know, you can do whatever, building up cliques in cities. And this is something that's counterintuitive, and people for some reason get mad at me saying this. It's just a recommendation. And I don't give a fuck if you're mad, but building up power centers in cities, quietly building little neighborhoods in cities, capital cities and so on. That's what the left is doing. You know, that's what they've been doing. And now, if you live in New York City, you start seeing the impact of that. So all the normal white people, me and Josh were talking about this, all the normal white people in New York have left. They moved to Long Island, or they moved to Pennsylvania, or they moved to New Jersey or so on. They all leave. And now what's left is this really – like you said, drug addicts, homeless people, and leftists. And of course, you know who. Those are the only people left in New York. And now it's fine if you say, oh, it's just a city. But New York is one of the power bases of planet Earth. So that's going to have not just national, but global implications. You know, and I think that this is kind of disturbing. I don't like the whole let's move out to the middle of nowhere. I mean, if you have to do it because you've got kids and stuff, do it. But I'm not saying that's politically a good idea.
Well, this, what I talked about on the third rail, and this is it's not about running away to the wilderness and living by yourself and creating maybe like your small little community. This is rural and urban reclamation, because what you're seeing is a collapse in both urban areas and a collapse in rural areas. And a lot of what you're so where a lot of people are congregating, where we're going to struggle with the most is where you have the really rich gated areas in cities, and it also like the really wealthy suburbs as well. Those are the people those are the strongholds of our enemies, basically. But if we can, but where there's collapsed areas, especially in both rural and urban areas, we can reclaim that, and we can build from there, and we can network through that. You need both. You can't have just like our own little rural spot that's isolated from everything. It's going to require a lot of different things.
You go live out in the Smoky Mountains somewhere, and they'll just send their drones up to kill you. Like it's that. It's just that some bug man in a city will fly a drone to come kill your family. Like that's how it's going to work. So like, you know, we have to start making a stand in a variety of context. We need a presence in the countryside, obviously. We also need a presence in the cities, you know. And I think that I kind of agree with what you're saying there, Borzoi.
I'm an urbanite, I don't live in the countryside. I live in a city. So I mean, and having walked around a number of different collapsed cities, I've seen the potential for like there's especially in the Rust Belt, there's cities that are just like they're so collapsed that the law enforcement barely has much of a presence, where if you once you get a lay of the situation, you can pretty much do whatever you want, as long, you know, I'm not advocating doing anything illegal, but in terms of if you don't want people watching you, if you want to create your own neighborhoods, like there are a lot of Rust Belt cities where, because people have moved out of those cities into rural areas and into suburbs, there's space and there is a lot of leeway there. You just got to know how to navigate it all.
And we also need to stop the urban versus rural divide in our movement. You know, oftentimes there's, and I'll do the big brain centrist here. The urban guys kind of are snobby with the rural guys, and that's wrong. But then also some rural types have this deeply, like, kind of deep-seated resentment against urban types, even ones that are ostensibly their allies. And that needs to end, okay? That's just my position on that. You know, no one has anything to prove to anyone. I think that a strong rural versus urban divide or antagonism is a strong symptom of a civilization that's about to collapse, in my opinion. You know, but what do I know?
All right, Glenn the Chimeman donates another $5. Anime and video games is the true global monoculture. Go anywhere in the world and ask a random person what their favorite anime is. They will have several answers for you.
And then punch them in the face once they tell you the answer.
Yeah. I mean, it's like fairy tales for adults. Like, that's what it is. Like, it's fucking... I don't watch... I used to think some... I think some of that, like, 80s anime, like...
Akira's a great movie.
Akira and stuff. Like, I like the... I like the scenery of it. I like the atmosphere of it, that kind of cyberpunk atmosphere that I think is kind of hard to capture in a live-action movie, although, obviously, there's exceptions like Blade Runner. But there's something very cool about that. I get it. But, like, I just don't get, like, the ones, like, adult men that like anime girls and dressed up like schoolgirls singing cute songs and stuff. I'm like, you know, this is probably unfair, but, and I'm not saying everyone's like this, but if you're an adult man who's into that, I'm going to, you know, just straight up, I'm just going to assume you're a child molester. Like, I'm just, I'm not saying it's fair, but I'm just saying if you see that, it's just like, I don't know. It's strange.
I will defend anime, that, but a lot of it in Japan is created specifically for a generally teenage or younger audience. A lot of anime is generally for a younger audience. It's just one of those things that's it has a broad appeal, and it's I mean, he's not wrong to point out that it's basically a global monoculture. There, it has its own issues with it.
It's like Disney, like. I can see the artistic value in, like, Spirited Away. Someone's mentioning that. I see some artistic value in that. Like, I would, Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. But, like, if I go on the internet and I make Snow White my avatar and I start identifying, like, with Snow White and Little Gopher. Yeah, if I start doing that stuff, I mean, it's a little strange. Wouldn't you say, as an adult man? It's like almost like collecting Barbies as an adult man. Like, it's something like that. It's a little odd. And I'm not blaming anyone who's doing that. Everything in our culture is made to infantilize you and so on like that. So I'm not blaming any individuals for partaking in that culture or even judging you. But
you're not the only one that feels that way. I mean, I don't know what the current current social sentiments are among the Japanese people, but I do know. Back around, at least in the 90s, the word otaku was a pejorative word, and it was especially because there was a bit of a concern about this kind of stuff, because one of the most infamous killers was of that time period was Tsutomu Miyazaki. He was a pedophile serial killer who raped and murdered four little girls. Who was I can't remember if this was accurate or not, but they called him the otaku killer because allegedly he was obsessed with a lot of that anime shit.
I mean, again, what do you think of this, Josh? What do you think as this person trained in psychology? What's your take on this stuff?
I don't know. I've never really. I think what it was. There's one Gundam or something. I don't even know what the fuck it is. This Zero Skids.
Anime's only bad if I don't like it.
There's some or Evangelion. Okay, so Zero.
I've seen Evangelion.
I maybe made it through two episodes with my girlfriend, and then we fucking gave up. So I don't know anything about it.
Check out the pause button on End of Evangelion.
You're not supposed to watch it with your girlfriend. If you have a girlfriend, it's not for you.
Yeah.
I'm surprised she wasn't your ex-girlfriend for that.
Yeah, she is now. I mean, I don't know. The people I know who are really fanatical about it tend to always be kind of stunted. No real careers, not really using their skills to the fullest ability, single often. Not that those, you know, like you're a bad person if that describes you, but you know, they tend to cluster around the same thing. Very juvenile, underachieving, perfectly fine people. They're my friends, or the ones I'm thinking of, but I kind of think of it as, look, I don't want to be like the old man on the porch shaking my fist, but there's just some shit like you got to get over, and like a lot of entertainment, almost regardless of whatever it is, falls in that category.
Yeah, it's not just, I don't want to just pick on the weeaboos out there. You know, if you're, you know, I mean, you kind of see it to a lesser degree with people that are into sports, right? Although that seems to be dying down now. But, you know, this kind of burning your energy in something that isn't really giving you anything back, and also contributing to your arrested development. Now, we could argue chicken or the egg. Does consuming this kind of content arrest your development, or the other way around? I can't say, but I will say that there weren't any weeaboos like even like 15 years ago. I mean, there were weeaboos.
Yes.
But, like,
what are you talking about?
Well, we used to fucking, not in Queens, we used to bully shit out of them.
Okay, that's fine. I can see there not being many weeaboos in Queens. I'm from Michigan. I can tell you there were a lot more than you might realize.
I'll tell you what really is weird is black weeaboos. That one I find really bizarre.
Bro, have you seen these black weeaboos? They're watching anime and shit.
I always talk about this, and people, it's become a meme. But yeah, every black man under the age of 30 now is some kind of homosexual or some kind of looks like some kind of anime character. I don't know how the fuck this happened. No one's ever studied it. Like, what's going on with young black men that they are transforming into very low testosterone, nerdy, fucking hysterical, very effeminate? What's that about? White men are increasingly more masculine than blacks under the age of 30, which is, I mean, I see it where I'm at. I live in not in New York. I live in another place, and I see young people of all types, and the young white guys, a lot of them are still kind of, you know, you still see like the football jock types. You see like the guy that goes to the gym and shit like that. But fucking with blacks, they all got pink hair. They're like mad skinny. They're fucking.
They jumped on the emo train like 20 years after white people abandoned it. I don't get it.
You know what the funny exception is to that though is blacks have always liked Dragon Ball Z and Yu-Gi-Oh, and you can find some really funny videos on YouTube of just the most ghetto ass blacks playing Yu-Gi-Oh and getting really really into it. It's some of the funniest stuff I've ever seen. It's one of my favorite red pills for people that blacks love Yu-Gi-Oh.
I gotta grab my e-cigarette. Just keep going, guys.
I don't know where I don't know, Josh, where I can take Blacks Love Yu-Gi-Oh. I was kind of waiting for Stryker's reaction to that, but he just stepped away.
I don't know anything about Yu-Gi-Oh either. I've seen the black guy's Dragon Ball Z thing.
Go ahead.
I guess that's cooler. I really don't know. I mean, these are all things I literally don't know anything about.
Dragon Ball Z is just I think that's especially a very millennial thing. I remember when I was I think it was in middle school. The person I talked to Dragon Ball Z with was the fat black kid in the back of class. So I don't know. It's just one of those things that's just kind of carried on just because there's a great well of nostalgia for that series because it ended some time ago and they brought it back with some new movies and a new TV show. So it's just,
well, they went
from having a little bit of a renaissance now.
Yeah, they went from 1991 Wu-Tang Clan, Japanese kung fu movies, the African oriental connection was strong. That was cool. And then within a generation, it's this weird shit. I don't get it.
Yeah, I've definitely dropped out of the culture completely. Most of the time I don't even know what's it big. I remember being surprised at just how huge Marvel stuff was with the demographics that, you know, like, I guess Bug Black is what we're talking about essentially, but it is a very weird thing to see, and I don't really, it's hard. I mean, obviously this is mostly environmental, but you end up trying to find multiple different explanations for it.
Hey, I'm back.
Hey. All right. Well, after that dissertation on Blacks and Yu-Gi-Oh, we got Mark donates $10. Love the squeaky toy. What dog did you end up getting, Mr. Dog? Also sounds like a great book. It's a German Shepherd.
Oh, nice.
Yep. Rafael Trujillo donates $1. He included a video with it. If anyone wants to check it out, it's like 7 minutes long. I'm not playing it. It's a Chivo2121 underscore on Twitter, but our donor says, "Do you know the most hardcore white supremacists online are Dominicans?" I'm not surprised by that person. you're going by Rafael Trujillo. I mean, this is a guy who literally had a whitening program in the Dominican Republic, and they massacred Haitians off their side of the island.
Yeah, yeah. I've met Dominicans. I actually once met a white Dominican. I have met one before. But yeah, most of them are kind of like mixed race or a little bit like that. But they have, interestingly enough, a very strong anti-black identity. And I think part of that is just being neighbors with Haiti. You know, it's like me and Josh were talking about, like, proximity is what will inform your opinions on things. And if you share an island with Haiti, you're going to have a different opinion of blacks and blackness than someone who doesn't, right? So I think that's a very interesting phenomenon.
And people don't notice, like, they literally, under the Trujillo regime, they literally just unleashed Dominicans and the army, militias, regular people. They just unleashed them, and they just literally massacred any Haitians that had begun to populate just across the border on the Dominican side of the island. And basically, there was no more Haitians in that area for quite a long time.
I remember there was this Dominican guy that I used to work with, and he used to like make some really. He's probably part black. I mean, I gotta be honest, but he used to make some funny fucking jokes. Like, he would say, "Yeah, man, my favorite part of Grand Theft Auto Vice City is killing all the Haitians." And I'm like, "Huh, that's funny. I got SS bolts on my bomber jacket, and I think you're a little extreme." But anyway, let's continue.
All right, he was a little bit late tonight. I was getting nervous that we made him unhappy. But Xi Jinping donates his weekly $5, so we're in the clear. You praised China enough, Striker, so he gave us our $5.
Oh, fucking hey, that's why I do it.
Blue Division donates $5. The heel turn days and early TPS kept me sane in a very hard time in my life. Nothing but love for Striker and Borzoi. A stiff right arm to you. Stiff right arm to you, Josh. I love the EBL channel. Reminds me of what a grug I am.
Oh, Blue Division is a really nice kid. He's a good boy, so I'm glad that we were able to help him out in that way. Yeah. You still there, Josh?
I'm still here. I actually didn't hear what the comment directed at me was, though.
Oh, stiff right arm to you, Josh, from Blue Division.
And what did he say?
He just has a stiff right arm to you.
Oh, stiff right arm. Thanks. Appreciate it.
Yeah, he loves the EBL channel.
Good. I'm not on there anymore, but enjoy it.
Yeah, Negro Lunch donates $14 to checking in. Cheers.
Oh, thank you, Negro Lunch. See you at the lunch counter.
Big Tone donates $10. Excellent stream, guys. Just bought your book, Josh. NYCWN represent.
Oh, yes. I won't give any more details, but Big Tone is a good boy. He's a good man.
Yeah, thanks for getting a copy of the book. You'll enjoy it. Next time I see you, I'll sign it. I mean, next time I never see you because I've never seen you.
All right, that's it for donations.
All righty. So tell us, Josh, the best way to get your book, the best way to contact or interact with your materials, and so on and so on. Just plug your shit.
So buy it from Imperium Press's website, imperiumpress.org. Leave a review or stars on Amazon for the marketing. Don't give Amazon your money. They charge more for the book. We get less for the book. So give all of your money to Mike and the guys at Imperium. They are very stand-up guys, very brilliant. They're doing great work. As you guys probably well know, it's hard. If you're doing creative stuff, it's hard to find people you can work with. And it's been an absolute pleasure work with Mike, stand-up guy. You know, one of the reasons I went forward with Imperium Press, and look, I sent my book to a lot of people. I sent it to Zero Books. They wrote me back. You know, I sent it to fucking everybody.
Oh, what does Zero Books tell you about it?
That's a funny story. I'll get to that. But Mike immediately understood the value of the book and asked, or you know, said we would publish it if you'd be interested. They knew exactly what we were on the same wavelength from the very beginning. So they're great. Give them your money. Leave the stars reviews on Amazon. Watch Thamster Witness YouTube channel. Jefferson and I are on a bit of a hiatus at the moment, but they have a new program called Theopolitics with the podcaster formerly known as Fashy Zizek. If you want to contact me, you're going to have to talk to Imperium Press. So find them on Twitter, at Imperium Press. Shoot them a message. I guess he's my agent now. He's booking all of my shows. So, Zero Books, funny story. I sent a copy to them, and they're like, well, geez, this guy uses a lot of radical left citations. Like it was like a very begrudging email. They're like, well, basically, this sounds like IDW-adjacent stuff, but he's using a lot of radical left citations and theoreticians in his work, so we don't really understand. He sent, because they asked, when you submit a book to them, they ask who else you're sending the manuscript to. So I said, well, Imperium Press and Redix. And they're like, well, he's sending this manuscript to publishing houses, so it must be a mistake that he sent it to us. And I'm like, not a mistake, dude. Like, half the books I own are from Zero Books. Like, I love the stuff that they do. They've got a lot of great writers. But, you know, this is the problem with the left, which is why I'm a little bit ambivalent about, like, reaching out to these people. Is they're just so hung up on their identity, and it's
important. Yeah,
it's
really, no, that guy, really hard. The guy that runs Zero Books, Douglas Lane, is an obnoxious spurg, and yeah. That guy is very, very puts a lot of stock into identifying as a leftist and the left versus right dichotomy. And if you're creating intellectual books that are meant to test people's limits and break new ground and so on, that's a terrible decision to have that man leading your publishing house. Someone that's so closed-minded as that guy. And the quality of Zero Books' books has also fallen on his dime, on his watch. I'm sorry. I think that overall, it's a huge tragedy, because a lot of people, the problem they have at Zero Books that I've heard is that a lot of people that started off writing for them later became right wing or even third position or something like that. And so, like, they have this guy there to basically appease the critics. So yeah, you're never, I'm surprised. I mean, I would even have sent it to them for review because they'll probably just read it in secret and be like, mm-hmm. this is interesting. And then they'll just like publicly denounce it if it gets big enough. Like that's how these leftists are. They treat us like we're fat chicks. They treat us like fat chicks that they fuck in secret. And then they steal our ideas. That's how they always do. The conservatives are the worst with that. Conservatives are the worst. I don't want to toot my own horn, but I see ideas that I know that I'm the one that came up with them. Concepts, ideas, and things I've coined. And then I'm not complaining about this, by the way, but I only complain about it when they take the idea and they manipulate it to take the point of the idea out of it. So, like, if we're talking about the PayPal situation or censorship or something, and you take certain reporting I do or something like that, and then you kind of sanitize it so that there's no Jewish element to it, well, then I'm going to fucking resent that, okay? I'm going to resent that. Yeah, Darren Beatty's a great example. Darren Beatty, the stuff you see on Revolver News, like, stuff like that. Like, they're constantly – these people are fucking constantly taking our ideas, which is fine. It's not about my ego. But don't do that to suit some stupid end like keeping Donald Trump in power or something. That's not the point. The point is to start an actual conversation about the real sovereign in this country, you know?
The other thing about, just to beat up on Zero Books a little bit more, I mean, with the big book they published last year was a rebuttal to Jordan Peterson, and they published it like 2 or 3 years after the pinnacle of the guy's career. So, like, talk about being really cutting edge, guys. You know, 10 years ago, you published Capitalist Realism, like, literally birthed an international political movement and philosophy.
Yeah.
Now they're publishing books like that are critiques of guys who are no longer even relevant. So these people shoot themselves in the foot.
They finally caught up to the bread tube.
Yeah. Well, you know, funny is one other thing about Zero Books that I find so weird is that they treat Jordan Peterson like he's the leader of the right or like the radical right or something when he's not. He's absolutely not. And the fact that they expend so much energy on that makes me think that they wish he was the leader of the radical right. Like, why don't we talk about, say, Mike Enoch? You know, Michael Pavich has been called by the Anti-Defamation League and the SPLC. You know, not that they have any virtue, anything they say, but they have labeled him the most influential white nationalist in America. And this is actually recently. So why doesn't Zero Books write a takedown of things Mike says? You know, Jordan Peterson is just he's just like some kind of the intellectual dark web in general is just an intellectual circle jerk. They should name it that. The intellectual circle jerk.
Well, these are all people. I was thinking about this the other day because obviously Eric Weinstein kind of went viral with the now infamous tweet thread he made, giving the middle finger and all that kind of thing. And it's like, why is this guy a discourse manager? Like, what did he a mathematician? Did he even do anything in mathematics or physics? So his brother? So like, help me understand this because I really don't understand. His brother Brett gets fired. He gets fired, and that makes him an icon. And so he's the brother of a guy who got fired for being 1 or 2 degrees less extreme than the people he had been teaching for several decades. So, like, these are the people who are the vanguard of American discourse. Give me a fucking break.
Well, I think Mr. Weinstein's surname helps him in more ways than one. Let's just say that. Anyway.
We had one more donation comment. Bucko Media donates $3. Are Argentinians like Leo Messi white? Leo Messi is almost entirely Italian in heritage.
Yeah, no, there are literally millions. I mean, I have family from Argentina and Uruguay, and they're fucking 100% white. Like, literally, like, my great-grandparents or grandparents were born in Europe. So you can it is possible to speak Spanish and be of European descent, contrary to popular belief. And Messi, to my knowledge, is entirely White, and what's the other one? Fuck, who's the other soccer player? Oh, anyway, it's a long story. But anyway, yes, of course, he's also the greatest soccer player in the world, if I recall correctly.
I don't know.
I'm not sure about soccer, sir.
Yeah. Any more?
No, I'm not refreshing again. So if you just send a donation in, I'm not reading it.
Okay.
I'm tired. So, I want to go to bed. I have to go do stuff tomorrow.
No. Yeah, no worries. Anyway, Josh, where's your Twitter? Where can people find you? Where can people contact you and so on? You said Imperium Books.
Yeah, message Imperium Press on Twitter. I am unreachable.
Okay, fantastic. Alrighty. So, anything else, Borzoi?
I got no major plugs at this time. There's gonna be a third rail tomorrow. I won't be on it, but I can confirm there's a third rail tomorrow. Spectre is hosting tomorrow, so everybody will enjoy that.
Oh, Spectre's back.
Yeah, that's right. So I teased that last week, and I kind of didn't like tell people until the morning. But yeah, so the big guest we had on third rail last week was Spectre. He is back. He is back permanently, or at least for the time being, he's back permanently. Who knows with him? Like, knowing Spectre, he's going to tell me in 6 hours. Yeah, I need to take another 5 month sabbatical. But no, he's back. He's hosting. He's back in the saddle. So if you missed the last third rail, go check it out. He came out swinging.
Fantastic. Good to hear that. Spectre's a good guy. All right. So in my case, yeah, you can catch us because people were asking before. If you missed most of the stream, you can catch it on the rightstuff.biz. Click the People Square tab on the right, and we're going to have the MP3 archive there. All right? That's about it.
All right. You're not going to really hear the music because I took off voice mirror, but I'm playing it now. All right. Good night, everybody.
Easy. Take care, everyone.